Top step, Langdon rushed out onto the sanctuary floor but was immediately lost in a curtain of blackness. I can't see. As he inched forward in the darkness, his eyes strained to adjust from the glow of the oil lamps below. Umbra arrived beside him, squinting as well.
Over here!
Benya shouted with desperation. They moved toward the sound, finally spotting the priest on the murky fringes of light that spilled from the stairwell. Father Benya was on his knees, crouched over the dark silhouette of a body. They were at Benya's side in a moment, and Langdon recoiled to see the body of Agent Diaz lying on the floor, his head twisted grotesquely. Diaz was flat on his stomach, but his head had been wrenched 180 degrees backward, so his lifeless eyes aimed up at the cathedral ceiling. Langdon cringed in horror, now understanding the panic in Father Benya's screams. A cold rush of fear coursed through him, and he stood abruptly, probing the darkness for any sign of movement in the cavernous church.
"His gun,"
Umbra whispered, pointing to Diaz's empty holster.
"It's gone."
She peered into the darkness around them and called out,
"Agent Fonseca!"
In the blackness nearby, there was a sudden shuffling of footsteps on tile and the sound of bodies colliding in a fierce struggle. Then, with startling abruptness, the deafening explosion of a gunshot rang out at close range. Langdon, Umbra, and Benya all jolted backward, and as the gunshot echoed across the sanctuary, they heard a pained voice urging,
"Corre! Run!"
A second gunshot exploded, followed by a heavy thud, the unmistakable sound of a body hitting the floor. Langdon had already grabbed Umbra's hand and was pulling her toward the deep shadows near the side wall of the sanctuary. Father Benya arrived a step behind them, all three now cowering in rigid silence against the cold stone. Langdon's eyes probed the darkness as he struggled to make sense of what was going on. Someone just killed Diaz and Fonseca. Who's in here with us, and what do they want? Langdon could imagine only one logical answer. The killer lurking in the darkness of Sagrada Familia had not come here to murder two random Guardia agents. He had come for Umbra and Langdon. Someone is still trying to silence Edmund's discovery. Suddenly a bright flashlight flared in the middle of the sanctuary floor, the beam swinging back and forth in a wide arc, moving in their direction. Langdon knew they had only seconds before the beam reached them.
"This way,"
Benya whispered, pulling Umbra along the wall in the opposite direction. Langdon followed as the light swung closer. Benya and Umbra suddenly cut hard to the right, disappearing into an opening in the stone, and Langdon plunged in after them, immediately stumbling on an unseen set of stairs. Umbra and Benya climbed onward as Langdon regained his footing and continued after them, looking back to see the beam of light appear just beneath him, illuminating the bottom steps. Langdon froze in the darkness, waiting. The light remained there a long moment, and then it began growing brighter.
"He's coming this way."
Langdon could hear Umbra and Benya ascending the stairs above him as stealthily as possible. He spun and launched himself after them, but again stumbled, colliding with a wall and realizing that the staircase was not straight but curved. Pressing a hand against the wall for guidance, Langdon began circling upward in a tight spiral, quickly understanding where he was. Sagrada Familia's infamously treacherous spiral staircase. He raised his eyes and saw a very faint glow filtering down from the light wells above, just enough illumination to reveal the narrow shaft that enclosed him. Langdon felt his legs tighten, and he stalled on the stairs, overcome by claustrophobia in the crushingly small passage.
"Keep climbing."
His rational mind urged him upward, but his muscles cramped in fear. Somewhere beneath him, Langdon could hear the sound of heavy footsteps approaching from the sanctuary. He forced himself to keep moving, following the spiraling steps upward as fast as he could. Above him, the faint light grew brighter as Langdon passed an opening in the wall, a wide slit through which he briefly glimpsed the city lights. A blast of cool air hit him as he dashed past this light well, and he plunged back into darkness as he circled higher. Footsteps entered the staircase below, and the flashlight probed erratically up the center shaft. Langdon passed another light well as the pursuing footsteps grew louder, his assailant now charging faster up the stairs behind him. Langdon caught up with Umbra and Father Benya, who was now gasping for breath. Langdon peered over the inner edge of the stairwell into the plunging center shaft. The drop was dizzying, a narrow, circular hole that plummeted through the eye of what looked like a giant, spiraling nautilus. There was virtually no barrier, just an ankle-high inner lip that provided no protection whatsoever. Langdon had to fight off a wave of nausea. He turned his eyes back to the darkness of the shaft overhead. Langdon had heard that there were more than 400 stairs in this structure. If so, there was no way they would reach the top before the armed man below caught up with them.
"Both of you, go!"
Benya gasped, stepping aside and urging Langdon and Umbra to pass him.
"There's no chance of that, Father,"
Umbra said, reaching down to help the old priest. Langdon admired her protective instinct, but he also knew that fleeing up these stairs was suicide, most likely ending with bullets in their backs. Of the two animal instincts for survival, fight or flight, flight was no longer an option.
"We'll never make it."
Letting Umbra and Father Benya press on, Langdon turned, planted his feet, and faced down the spiral staircase. Below him, the flashlight beam tracked closer. He backed against the wall and crouched in the shadows, waiting until the light hit the stairs beneath him. The killer suddenly rounded the curve into view, a dark form running with both hands outstretched, one clutching the flashlight and the other a handgun. Langdon reacted on instinct, exploding from his crouch and launching himself through the air feet first. The man saw him and began to raise his gun just as Langdon's heels drove into his chest with a powerful thrust, driving the man back into the wall of the stairwell. The next few seconds were a blur. Langdon fell, landing hard on his side, pain erupting in his hip, as his attacker crumpled backward, tumbling down several stairs and landing in a groaning heap. The flashlight bounced down the stairs and rolled to a stop, sending an oblique wash of light up the sidewall and illuminating a metal object on the stairs halfway between Langdon and his attacker. The gun. Both men lunged for it at the same moment, but Langdon had the high ground and got there first, grasping the handle and pointing the weapon at his attacker, who stopped short just beneath him, staring defiantly into the barrel of the gun. In the glow of the flashlight, Langdon could see the man's salt-and-pepper beard and stark white pants. And in an instant, he knew who it was. The Navy officer from the Guggenheim. Langdon leveled the gun at the man's head, feeling his index finger on the trigger. "You killed my friend Edmund Kirsch." The man was out of breath, but his reply was immediate. His voice, like ice.
"I settled the score. Your friend Edmund Kirsch killed my family."
Chapter 75.
"Langdon broke my ribs."
Admiral Avila felt sharp stabs each time he inhaled, wincing in pain as his chest heaved desperately, trying to restore oxygen to his body. Crouched on the stairs above him, Robert Langdon stared down, aiming the pistol awkwardly at Avila's midsection. Avila's military training instantly kicked in, and he began assessing his situation. In the negative column, his enemy held both the weapon and the high ground. In the positive column, judging from the professor's unusual grip on the gun, he had very little experience with firearms. "He has no intention of shooting me," Avila decided. "He will hold me and wait for the security guards." From all the shouting outside, it was clear that Sagrada Familia's security officers had heard the gunshots and were now hurrying into the building.
"I must act quickly."
Keeping his hands raised in surrender, Avila shifted slowly onto his knees, conveying full compliance and submission. Give Langdon the sense that he is in total control. Despite his fall down the stairs, Avila could feel that the object he had lodged in the back of his belt was still there, the ceramic pistol with which he had killed Kirsch inside the Guggenheim. He had chambered the last remaining bullet before entering the church, but had not needed to use it, killing one of the guards silently and stealing his far more efficient gun, which, unfortunately, Langdon was now aiming at him. Avila wished he had left the safety engaged, guessing Langdon probably would have had no idea how to release it. Avila considered making a move to grab the ceramic gun from his belt to fire on Langdon first, but even if he were successful, Avila estimated his chances of survival at about 50-50. One of the perils of inexperienced gun users was their tendency to fire by mistake.
If I move too quickly...
The sounds of the yelling guards were growing closer, and Avila knew that if he were taken into custody, the victor tattoo on his palm would ensure his release, or at least that's what the regent had assured him. At the moment, however, having killed two of the king's Guardia Real agents, Avila was not so sure that the regent's influence could save him.
I came here to carry out a mission, Avila reminded himself, and I need to complete it. Eliminate Robert Langdon and Ambra Vidal.
The regent had told Avila to enter the church via the east service gate, but Avila had decided to jump a security fence instead.
I spotted police lurking near the east gate, and so I improvised.
Langdon spoke forcefully, glaring down over the gun at Avila.
You said Edmund Kirsch killed your family. That's a lie. Edmund was no killer.
You're right, Avila thought. He was worse. The dark truth about Kirsch was a secret Avila had learned only a week ago during a phone call from the regent.
Our Pope is asking you to target the famous futurist Edmund Kirsch, the regent had said.
His Holiness's motivations are many, but he would like for you to undertake this mission personally.
Why me? Avila asked.
Admiral, the regent whispered, I'm sorry to tell you this, but Edmund Kirsch was responsible for the cathedral bombing that killed your family. Avila's first reaction was complete disbelief. He could see no reason whatsoever for a well-known computer scientist to bomb a church.
You are a military man, Admiral, the regent had explained to him, and so you know better than anyone. The young soldier who pulls the trigger in battle is not the actual killer. He is a pawn, doing the work of those more powerful, governments, generals, religious leaders, those who have either paid him or convinced him that a cause is worthy at all costs.
Avila had indeed witnessed this situation. The same rules apply to terrorism, the regent continued. The most vicious terrorists are not the people who build the bombs, but the influential leaders who fuel hatred among desperate masses, inspiring their foot soldiers to commit acts of violence. It takes only one powerful dark soul to wreak havoc in the world by inspiring spiritual intolerance, nationalism, or loathing in the minds of the vulnerable.
Avila had to agree.
Terrorist attacks against Christians, the regent said, are on the rise around the world. These new attacks are no longer strategically planned events. They are spontaneous assaults carried out by lone wolves who are answering a call to arms sent out by persuasive enemies of Christ. The regent paused. And among those persuasive enemies, I count the atheist Edmund Kirsch. Now Avila felt the regent was beginning to stretch the truth. Despite Kirsch's despicable campaign against Christianity in Spain, the scientist had never issued a statement urging the murder of Christians. Before you disagree, the voice on the phone told him, let me give you one final piece of information. The regent sighed heavily. Nobody knows this, Admiral, but the attack that killed your family, it was intended as an act of war against the Palmerian Church. The statement gave Avila pause, and yet it made no sense. Seville Cathedral was not a Palmerian building. The morning of the bombing, the voice told him, four prominent members of the Palmerian Church were in the Seville congregation for recruiting purposes. They were targeted specifically.
You know one of them, Marco. The other three died in the attack.
Avila's thoughts swirled as he pictured his physical therapist, Marco, who had lost his leg in the attack. Our enemies are powerful and motivated, the voice went on, and when the bomber could not gain access to our compound in El Palmar de Troya, he followed our four missionaries to Seville and took his action there.
I'm so very sorry, Admiral. This tragedy is one of the reasons the Palmerians reached out to you. We feel responsible that your family became collateral damage in a war directed against us. A war directed by whom? Avila demanded, trying to comprehend the shocking claims. Check your email, the regent replied. Opening his inbox, Avila discovered a shocking trove of private documents that outlined a brutal war that had been waged against the Palmerian Church for over a decade now. A war that apparently included lawsuits, threats bordering on blackmail, and huge donations to anti-Palmerian watchdog groups like Palmar de Troya Support and Dialogue Ireland. More surprising still, this bitter war against the Palmerian Church was, it appeared, being waged by a single individual, and that man was futurist Edmund Kirsch. Avila was baffled by the news. Why would Edmund Kirsch specifically want to destroy the Palmerians? The regent told him that nobody in the church, not even the Pope himself, had any idea why Kirsch had such a specific abhorrence for the Palmerians. All they knew was that one of the planet's wealthiest and most influential people would not rest until the Palmerians were crushed. The regent drew Avila's attention to one last document, a copy of a typed letter to the Palmerians from a man claiming to be the Seville bomber. In the first line, the bomber called himself a disciple of Edmund Kirsch. This was all Avila had to see, his fists clenched in rage. The regent explained why the Palmerians had never shared the letter publicly. With all the bad press the Palmerians had gotten recently, much of it orchestrated or funded by Kirsch, the last thing the church needed was to be associated with a bombing. My family died because of Edmund Kirsch. Now in the darkened stairwell, Avila stared up at Robert Langdon, sensing that the man probably knew nothing of Kirsch's secret crusade against the Palmerian Church, or how Kirsch had inspired the attack that killed Avila's family. It doesn't matter what Langdon knows, Avila thought. He is a soldier like I am. We have both fallen into this foxhole, and only one of us will climb out of it. I have my orders. Langdon was positioned a few steps above him, aiming his weapon like an amateur, with both hands. Poor choice, Avila thought, quietly lowering his toes onto a step beneath him, planting his feet and staring straight up into Langdon's eyes.
I know you find it hard to believe, Avila declared, but Edmund Kirsch killed my family, and here is your proof.
Avila opened his palm to show Langdon his tattoo, which, of course, was no proof at all, but it had the desired effect. Langdon looked. As the professor's focus shifted ever so briefly, Avila lunged upward and to his left along the curved outer wall, moving his body out of the line of fire. Precisely as anticipated, Langdon fired on impulse, depressing the trigger before he could realign the weapon with a moving target. Like thunder, the gunshot reverberated in the cramped space, and Avila felt a bullet graze his shoulder before ricocheting harmlessly down the stone stairwell. Langdon was already re-aiming the gun, but Avila rolled in midair, and as he began to fall, he drove his fists down hard on Langdon's wrists, forcing the gun from his hands and sending it clattering down the stairs. Bolts of pain ripped through Avila's chest and shoulder as he landed on the stairs beside Langdon. But the surge of adrenaline only fueled his intensity. Reaching behind him, he yanked the ceramic handgun from his belt. The weapon felt almost weightless after holding the guard's pistol. Avila pointed the gun at Langdon's chest, and without hesitation, he pulled the trigger. The gun roared, but it made an unusual shattering noise, and Avila felt searing heat on his hand, realizing at once that the gun barrel had exploded. Built for stealth, these new metal-free undetectables were intended for only a shot or two. Avila had no idea where his bullet had gone, but when he saw Langdon already scrambling to his feet, Avila dropped his weapon and lunged at him, the two men grappling violently near the precariously low inner edge. In that instant, Avila knew he had won. We are equally armed, he thought, but I have position. Avila had already assessed the open shaft at the center of the stairwell, a deadly drop with almost no protection. Now, Trying to muscle Langdon backward toward the shaft, Avila pressed one leg against the outer wall, giving himself enormous leverage. With a surge of power, he pushed Langdon toward the shaft. Langdon fiercely resisted, but Avila's position afforded him all the advantage, and from the desperate look in the professor's eyes, it was clear that Langdon knew what was about to happen. Robert Langdon had heard it said that life's most critical choices, those involving survival, usually required a split-second decision. Now, brutally driven against the low edge, with his back arched over a 100-foot drop, Langdon's 6-foot frame and high center of gravity were a deadly liability. He knew he could do nothing to counter the power of Avila's position. Langdon desperately peered over his shoulder into the void behind him. The circular shaft was narrow, maybe 3 feet across, but it was certainly wide enough to accommodate his plummeting body, which would likely carry him off the stone railing all the way down. The fall is unsurvivable. Avila let out a guttural bellow and re-gripped Langdon. As he did, Langdon realized there was only one move to make. Rather than fighting the man, he would help him. As Avila heaved him upward, Langdon crouched, planting his feet firmly on the stairs. For a moment, he was a 20-year-old at the Princeton swimming pool, competing in the backstroke, perched on his mark, his back to the water, knees bent, abdomen taut, waiting for the starting gun. Timing is everything. This time, Langdon heard no starting gun. He exploded out of his crouch, launching himself into the air, arching his back out over the void. As he leaped outward, he could feel that Avila, who had been poised to oppose 200 pounds of dead weight, had been yanked entirely off balance by the sudden reversal of forces. Avila let go as fast as he possibly could, but Langdon could sense him flailing for equilibrium. As Langdon arched away, he prayed he could travel far enough in the air to clear the opening and reach the stairs on the opposite side of the shaft, 6 feet below. But apparently, it was not to be. In midair, as Langdon began instinctively folding his body into a protective ball, he collided hard with a vertical face of stone. "I didn't make it. I'm dead." Certain he had hit the inner edge, Langdon braced himself for his plummet into the void, but the fall lasted only an instant. Langdon crashed down almost immediately on sharp, uneven ground, striking his head. The force of the collision nearly knocked him into unconsciousness, but in that moment he realized he had cleared the shaft completely and hit the far wall of the staircase, landing on the lower portion of the spiraling stairs. "Find the gun," Langdon thought, straining to hold on to consciousness, knowing that Avila would be on top of him in a matter of seconds. But it was too late. His brain was shutting down. As the blackness set in, the last thing Langdon heard was an odd sound, a series of recurring thuds beneath him, each one farther away than the one before. It reminded him of the sound of an oversized bag of garbage careening down a trash chute. Chapter 76. As Prince Julian's vehicle approached the main gate of El Escorial, he saw a familiar barricade of white SUVs and knew Valdespino had been telling the truth. "My father is indeed in residence here. From the looks of this convoy, the king's entire Guardia Real security detail had now relocated to this historical royal residence." As the acolyte brought the old opal to a stop, an agent with a flashlight strode over to the window, shone the light inside, and recoiled in shock, clearly not expecting to find the prince and the bishop inside the dilapidated vehicle.
"Your Highness," the man exclaimed, jumping to attention. "Your Excellency, we've been expecting you."
He eyed the beat-up car.
"Where is your guardia detail?"
"They were needed at the palace," the prince replied. "We're here to see my father."
"Of course, of course. If you and the bishop would please get out of the vehicle. Just move the roadblock," Valdespino scolded, "and we'll drive in. His Majesty is in the monastery hospital, I assume?"
"He was," the guard said, hesitating.
but I'm afraid now he's gone.
Valdespino gasped, looking horrified. An icy chill gripped Julian.
My father is dead?
No, I'm so sorry.
The agent stammered, regretting his poor choice of words.
His Majesty is gone. He left El Escorial an hour ago. He took his lead security detail and they left.
Julian's relief turned quickly to confusion. Left the hospital here?
That's absurd, Valdespino yelled. The king told me to bring Prince Julian here right away.
Yes, we have specific orders, Your Excellency, and if you would, please exit the car so we can transfer you both to a Guardia vehicle.
Valdespino and Julian exchanged puzzled looks and dutifully got out of the car. The agent advised the acolyte that his services were no longer required and that he should return to the palace. The frightened young man sped off into the night without a word, clearly relieved to end his role in this evening's bizarre events. As the guards guided the prince and Valdespino into the back of an SUV, the bishop became increasingly agitated.
"Where is the king?" he demanded. "Where are you taking us?"
"We are following His Majesty's direct orders," the agent said. "He asked us to give you a vehicle, a driver, and this letter."
The agent produced a sealed envelope and handed it through the window to Prince Julian. "A letter from my father?" The prince was disconcerted by the formality, especially when he noticed that the envelope bore the royal wax seal.
What is he doing?
He felt increasing concern that the king's faculties might be failing. Anxiously, Julian broke the seal, opened the envelope, and extracted a handwritten note card. His father's penmanship was not what it used to be, but was still legible. As Julian began to read the letter, he felt his bewilderment growing with every word. When he finished, he slipped the card back into the envelope and closed his eyes, considering his options. There was only one, of course.
"Drive north, please," Julian told the driver.
As the vehicle pulled away from El Escorial, the prince could feel Valdespino staring at him.
"What did your father say?"
the bishop demanded.
"Where are you taking me?"
Julian exhaled and turned to his father's trusted friend.
"You said it best earlier."
He gave the aging bishop a sad smile.
"My father is still the king. We love him, and we do as he commands."
Chapter 77
"Robert?"
a voice whispered. Langdon tried to respond, but his head was pounding.
"Robert?"
A soft hand touched his face, and Langdon slowly opened his eyes. Momentarily disoriented, he actually thought he was dreaming. "An angel in white is hovering over me." When Langdon recognized her face, he managed a weak smile.
"Thank God,"
Ambra said, exhaling all at once.
"We heard the gunshot."
She crouched beside him.
"Stay down."
As Langdon's awareness returned, he felt a sudden rush of fear.
"The man who attacked—"
"He's gone,"
Ambra whispered, her voice calm.
"You're safe."
She gestured over the edge of the shaft.
"He fell, all the way down."
Langdon strained to absorb the news. It was all slowly coming back. He fought to clear the fog from his mind and take inventory of his wounds, his attention moving to the deep throbbing in his left hip and the sharp pain in his head. Otherwise, nothing felt broken. The sound of police radios echoed up the stairwell.
"How long have I been—"
"A few minutes," Ambra said. "You've been in and out. We need to get you checked."
Gingerly, Langdon pulled himself to a sitting position, leaning against the wall of the staircase.
"It was the Navy officer," he said. "The one who—"
"I know," Ambra said, nodding. "The one who killed Edmund. The police just ID'd him. They're at the bottom of the stairwell with the body, and they want a statement from you, but Father Benya told them nobody comes up here before the medical team, who should be here any minute now."
Langdon nodded, his head pounding.
They'll probably take you to the hospital, Ambra told him, which means you and I need to talk right now, before they arrive.
Talk? About what?
Ambra studied him, looking concerned. She leaned down close to his ear and whispered,
Robert, don't you remember? We found it. Edmund's password. The dark religions are departed and sweet science reigns.
Her words pierced the fog like an arrow, and Langdon bolted upright, the murkiness in his mind clearing abruptly.
You've brought us this far, Ambra said. I can do the rest. You said you know how to find Winston. The location of Edmund's computer lab? Just tell me where to go, and I'll do the rest.
Langdon's memories rushed back now in torrents.
I do know. At least, I think I can figure it out.
Tell me.
We need to go across town.
Where?
I don't know the address, Langdon said, now climbing unsteadily to his feet. But I can take you.
Sit down, Robert, please,
Ambra said.
Yes, sit down,
a man echoed, coming into view on the stairs below them. It was Father Benya, trudging up the staircase, breathless.
The EMTs are almost here.
I'm fine, Langdon lied, feeling woozy as he leaned against the wall. Ambra and I need to go now.
You won't get very far, Benya said, climbing slowly. The police are waiting. They want a statement. Besides, the church is surrounded by media. Someone tipped off the press that you're here.
The priest arrived beside them and gave Langdon a tired smile.
By the way, Ms. Vidal and I are relieved to see you're okay. You saved our lives.
Langdon laughed. I'm pretty sure you saved ours.
Well, in either case, I just want you to know that you'll be unable to leave this stairwell without facing the police.
Langdon carefully placed his hands on the stone railing and leaned out, peering down. The macabre scene on the ground seemed so far away. Avila's awkwardly splayed body illuminated by the beams of several flashlights in the hands of police officers. As Langdon peered down the spiral shaft, once again noting Gaudí's elegant Nautilus design, he flashed on the website for the Gaudí Museum in the basement of this church. The online site, which Langdon had visited not long ago, featured a spectacular series of scale models of Sagrada Familia, accurately rendered by CAD programs and massive 3D printers, depicting the long evolution of the structure from the laying of its foundation all the way to the church's glorious future completion, still at least a decade away. Where do we come from? Langdon thought. Where are we going? A sudden memory struck him. One of the scale models of the church's exterior. The image was lodged in his eidetic memory. It was a prototype depicting the church's current stage of construction and was titled Sagrada Familia Today. If that model is up to date, then there could be a way out. Langdon turned suddenly to Benya. Father, could you please relay a message from me to someone outside? The priest looked puzzled. As Langdon explained his plan to get out of the building, Ambra shook her head.
Robert, that's impossible. There's nowhere up there for...
Actually, Benya interjected, there is. It won't be there forever, but at the moment, Mr. Langdon is correct. What he's suggesting is possible.
Ambra looked surprised.
But, Robert, even if we can escape unseen, are you sure that you shouldn't go to the hospital?
Langdon wasn't sure of very much at this point. I can go later if I need to, he said. Right now, we owe it to Edmund to finish what we came here to do. He turned to Benya, looking him directly in the eye. I need to be honest with you, Father, about why we are here. As you know, Edmund Kirsch was murdered tonight to stop him from announcing a scientific discovery.
Yes, the priest said,
and from the tone of Kirsch's introduction, he seemed to believe this discovery would deeply damage the religions of the world.
Exactly. Which is why I feel you should know that Ms. Vidal and I came to Barcelona tonight in an effort to release Edmund Kirsch's discovery. We are very close to being able to do that, meaning, Langdon paused, in requesting your help right now, I'm essentially asking you to help us globally broadcast the words of an atheist.
Benya reached up and placed a hand on Langdon's shoulder.
Professor, he said with a chuckle, Edmund Kirsch is not the first atheist in history to proclaim that God is dead, nor will he be the last. Whatever it is that Mr. Kirsch has discovered, it will no doubt be debated on all sides. Since the beginning of time, the human intellect has always evolved, and it is not my role to impede that development. From my perspective, however, there has never been an intellectual advancement that has not included God.
With that, Father Benya gave them both a reassuring smile and headed down the stairs. Outside, waiting in the cockpit of the parked EC-145 helicopter, the pilot watched with rising concern as the crowd outside Sagrada Familia's security fence continued to grow. He had not heard from the two Guardia agents inside and was about to radio in when a small man in black robes emerged from the basilica and approached the chopper. The man introduced himself as Father Benya and relayed a shocking message from inside. Both Guardia agents had been killed, and the future Queen and Robert Langdon required evacuation at once. As if this weren't startling enough, the priest then told the pilot where precisely he was to collect his passengers. Impossible, the pilot had thought. And yet now, as he soared over the spires of Sagrada Familia, he realized that the priest had been correct. The church's largest spire, a monolithic central tower, had not yet been built. Its foundation platform was a flat, circular expanse nestled deep among a cluster of spires, like a clearing in a forest of redwoods. The pilot positioned himself high above the platform and carefully lowered the chopper down among the spires. As he touched down, he saw two figures emerge from a stairwell, Ambra Vidal assisting an injured Robert Langdon. The pilot jumped out and helped them both inside. As he strapped them in, the future Queen of Spain gave him a weary nod.
Thank you very much, she whispered. Mr. Langdon will tell you where to go.
Chapter 78 ConspiracyNet.com Breaking News Palmerian Church killed Edmund Kirsch's mother? Our informant, monte@iglesia.org, has come through with yet another blockbuster revelation. According to exclusive documents verified by ConspiracyNet, Edmund Kirsch has attempted for years to sue the Palmerian Church for brainwashing, psychological conditioning, and physical cruelty, allegedly resulting in the death of Paloma Kirsch, Edmund's biological mother, more than 3 decades ago. Paloma Kirsch is alleged to have been an active member of the Palmerian Church who attempted to break free, was shamed and psychologically abused by her superiors, and hanged herself in a nunnery bedroom. Chapter 79
The King himself, Commander Garza muttered again, his voice resonating across the palace armory. I still can't fathom that my arrest order came from the king himself, after all my years of service.
Monica Martin placed a silencing finger to her lips and glanced through the suits of armor at the entryway to make sure the guards were not listening.
I told you, Bishop Valdespino has the king's ear, and has convinced his majesty that tonight's accusations against him are your doing and that you're somehow framing him.
I've become the king's sacrificial lamb, Garza realized.
always having suspected that if the king were forced to choose between his Guardia Real commander or Valdespino, he would choose Valdespino. The two men had been lifelong friends, and spiritual connections always trumped professional ones. Even so, Garza could not help but feel that something about Monica's explanation wasn't entirely logical.
"The kidnapping story," he said. "You're telling me that it was ordered by the king?"
"Yes. His Majesty called me directly. He ordered me to announce that Ambra Vidal had been abducted. He had concocted the kidnapping story in an effort to save the reputation of the future queen, to soften the appearance that she had literally run off with another man."
Martín gave Garza an annoyed look.
"Why are you questioning me about this? Especially now that you know the king phoned Agent Fonseca with the same kidnapping story.
I can't believe the king would ever risk falsely accusing a prominent American of kidnapping," Garza argued.
"He'd have to be insane," she interrupted.
Garza stared in silence.
"Commander," Martín pressed, "remember that His Majesty is failing. Maybe this was just a case of bad judgment."
"Or a moment of brilliance," Garza offered.
"Reckless or not, the future queen is now safe and accounted for in the hands of the Guardia."
"Exactly,"
Martín eyed him carefully.
"So, what's bothering you?"
"Valdespino," Garza said. "I admit I don't like him. But my gut says he can't possibly be behind Kirsch's murder, or any of the rest of it."
"Why not?"
Her tone was acerbic.
"Because he's a priest? I'm pretty sure our Inquisition taught us a few things about the Church's willingness to justify drastic measures. In my opinion, Valdespino is self-righteous, ruthless, opportunistic, and overly secretive. Am I missing something?"
"You are," Garza fired back, startled to find himself defending the bishop.
"Valdespino is everything you say he is, but he is also a person for whom tradition and dignity are everything. The king, who trusts almost no one, has steadfastly trusted the bishop for decades now. I find it very hard to believe that the king's confidant could ever commit the kind of treachery we're talking about."
Martín sighed and pulled out her cell phone.
"Commander, I hate to undermine your faith in the bishop, but I need you to see this. Suresh showed it to me."
She pressed a few buttons and handed Garza her phone. The screen displayed a long text message.
"This is a screenshot of a text message Bishop Valdespino received tonight," she whispered. "Read it. I guarantee it will change your mind."
Chapter 80. Despite the pain coursing through his body, Robert Langdon felt strangely buoyant, almost euphoric, as the helicopter thundered off the roof of Sagrada Familia. "I'm alive." He could feel the adrenaline build up in his bloodstream, as if all of the events of the past hour were now hitting him all at once. Breathing as slowly as possible, Langdon turned his attention outward to the world beyond the helicopter windows. All around him, massive church spires reached skyward. But as the helicopter rose, the church dropped away, dissolving into an illuminated grid of streets. Langdon gazed down at the sprawl of city blocks, which were not the usual squares and rectangles, but rather much softer octagons. Le Chample, Langdon thought. The widening. Visionary city architect Ildefonso Seda had widened all the intersections in this district by shaving the corners off the square blocks to create mini plazas, with better visibility, increased airflow, and abundant space for outdoor cafes. "¿A dónde vamos?" the pilot shouted over his shoulder. Langdon pointed two blocks to the south, where one of the city's widest, brightest, and most aptly named avenues cut diagonally across Barcelona.
"Avenida Diagonal,"
Langdon shouted.
"Al oeste,"
to the west. Impossible to miss on any map of Barcelona, Avenida Diagonal crossed the entire width of the city,
From the ultramodern beachside skyscraper Diagonal Cerro Cerro to the ancient rose gardens of Parque de Cervantes, a 10-acre tribute to Spain's most celebrated novelist, the author of Don Quixote. The pilot nodded his confirmation and banked to the west, following the slanting avenue westward toward the mountains.
Address? The pilot called back. Coordinates?
I don't know the address, Langdon realized.
Fly to the football stadium.
Football?
He seemed surprised.
FC Barcelona?
Langdon nodded, having no doubt the pilot knew exactly how to find the home of the famed Barcelona Football Club, which was located a few miles farther up Avinguda Diagonal. The pilot opened the throttle, now tracing the path of the avenue at full speed.
Robert?
Ambra asked quietly.
Are you okay?
She studied him as if perhaps his head injury had impaired his judgment.
You said you know where to find Winston.
I do, he replied. That's where I'm taking us.
A football stadium? You think Edmund built a supercomputer at a stadium?
Langdon shook his head. No, the stadium is just an easy landmark for the pilot to locate. I'm interested in the building directly beside the stadium, the Gran Hotel Princesa Sofia. Ambra's expression of confusion only deepened.
Robert, I'm not sure you're making sense. There's no way Edmund built Winston inside a luxury hotel. I think we should take you to the clinic after all.
I'm fine, Ambra, trust me.
Then where are we going?
Where are we going? Langdon stroked his chin playfully. I believe that's one of the important questions Edmund promised to answer tonight. Ambra's expression settled somewhere between amused and exasperated. Sorry, Langdon said. Let me explain. 2 years ago, I had lunch with Edmund at the private club on the 18th floor of the Gran Hotel Princesa Sofia.
And Edmund brought a supercomputer to lunch?
Ambra suggested with a laugh. Langdon smiled. Not quite. Edmund arrived for lunch on foot, telling me he ate at the club almost every day because the hotel was so convenient, only a couple of blocks from his computer lab. He also confided in me that he was working on an advanced synthetic intelligence project and was incredibly excited about its potential. Ambra looked suddenly heartened.
That must have been Winston.
My thoughts exactly.
And so Edmund took you to his lab?
No.
Did he tell you where it was?
Unfortunately, he kept that a secret. The concern rushed back into Ambra's eyes. However, Langdon said, Winston secretly told us exactly where it is. Now Ambra looked confused.
No, he didn't.
I assure you he did, Langdon said, smiling. He actually told the whole world. Before Ambra could demand an explanation, the pilot announced,
Ahí está el estadio.
He pointed into the distance at Barcelona's massive stadium. That was fast, Langdon thought, glancing outside and tracing a line from the stadium to the nearby Gran Hotel Princesa Sofia, a skyscraper overlooking a broad plaza on Avinguda Diagonal. Langdon told the pilot to bypass the stadium and instead take them up high over the hotel. Within seconds, the helicopter had climbed several hundred feet and was hovering above the hotel where Langdon and Edmund had gone to lunch 2 years ago. He told me his computer lab was only 2 blocks from here. From their bird's-eye vantage point, Langdon scanned the area around the hotel. The streets in this neighborhood were not as rectilinear as they were around Sagrada Familia, and the city blocks formed all kinds of uneven and oblong shapes. It has to be here. With rising uncertainty, Langdon searched the blocks in all directions, trying to spot the unique shape that he could picture in his memory. Where is it? It was not until he turned his gaze to the north, across the traffic circle, at the Plaza de Pius XII, that Langdon felt a twinge of hope. Over there, he called to the pilot. Please fly over that wooded area. The pilot tipped the nose of the chopper and moved diagonally one block to the northwest, now hovering over the forested expanse where Langdon had pointed. The woods were actually part of a massive walled estate.
"Robert!"
Umbra shouted, sounding frustrated now.
"What are you doing? This is the royal palace of Pedralbes. There's no way Edmund built Winston inside..."
"Not here. Over there." Langdon pointed beyond the palace to the block directly behind it. Umbra leaned forward, looking down intently at the source of Langdon's excitement. The block behind the palace was formed by four well-lit streets, intersecting to create a square that was oriented north-south, like a diamond. The diamond's only flaw was that its lower right border was awkwardly bent, skewed by an uneven jog in the line, leaving a crooked perimeter. "Do you recognize that jagged line?" Langdon asked, pointing to the diamond's skewed axis. A well-lit street, perfectly delineated against the darkness of the wooded palace grounds. "Do you see the street with the little jog in it?" All at once, Umbra's exasperation seemed to disappear, and she cocked her head to peer down more intently.
"Actually, that line is familiar. Why do I know it?"
"Look at the entire block," Langdon urged. "A diamond shape with one strange border in the lower right." He waited, sensing Umbra would recognize it soon. "Look at the two small parks on this block." He pointed to a round park in the middle and a semicircular park on the right.
"I feel like I know this place," Umbra said. "But I can't quite..."
"Think about art," Langdon said. "Think about your collection at the Guggenheim. Think about..."
"Winston!" she shouted and turned to him in disbelief. "The layout of this block, it's the exact shape of Winston's self-portrait in the Guggenheim."
Langdon smiled at her. "Yes, it is." Umbra wheeled back to the window and stared down at the diamond-shaped block. Langdon peered down too, picturing Winston's self-portrait. The bizarrely shaped canvas that had puzzled him ever since Winston had pointed it out to him earlier tonight. An awkward tribute to the work of Miro. "Edmund asked me to create a self-portrait," Winston had said, "and this is what I came up with." Langdon had already decided that the eyeball featured near the center of the piece, a staple of Miro's work, almost certainly indicated the precise spot where Winston existed, the place on the planet from which Winston viewed the world. Umbra turned back from the window, looking both joyful and stunned.
"Winston's self-portrait is not a Miro. It's a map."
"Exactly," Langdon said. "Considering Winston has no body and no physical self-image, his self-portrait, understandably, would be more related to his location than to his physical form."
"The eyeball," Umbra said. "It's a carbon copy of a Miro, but there's only one eye. So maybe that's what marks Winston's location?"
"I was thinking the same thing." Langdon turned to the pilot now and asked if he could set the helicopter down just for a moment on one of the two little parks on Winston's block. The pilot began to descend.
"My God," Amber blurted. "I think I know why Winston chose to mimic Miro's style."
"Oh?"
"The palace we just flew over is the palace of Pedralbes."
"Pedralbes?" Langdon asked. "Isn't that the name of..."
"Yes, one of Miro's most famous sketches. Winston probably researched this area and found a local tie to Miro."
Langdon had to admit Winston's creativity was astonishing, and he felt strangely exhilarated by the prospect of reconnecting with Edmund's synthetic intelligence. As the helicopter dropped lower, Langdon saw the dark silhouette of a large building located on the exact spot where Winston had drawn his eye.
"Look," Umbra pointed, "that must be it."
Langdon strained to get a better view of the building, which was obscured by large trees. Even from the air, it looked formidable. I don't see lights, Umbra said. Do you think we can get in?
Somebody's got to be here, Langdon said. Edmund must have staff on hand, especially tonight. When they realize we have Edmund's password, I suspect they will scramble to help us trigger the presentation. 15 seconds later, the helicopter touched down in a large semicircular park on the eastern border of Winston's block. Langdon and Umbra jumped out, and the chopper lifted off instantly, speeding toward the stadium, where it would await further instructions. As the two of them hurried across the darkened park toward the center of the block, they crossed a small internal street, Passage des Tillers, and moved into a heavily wooded area. Up ahead, shrouded by trees, they could see the silhouette of a large and bulky building.
No lights, Umbra whispered.
And a fence, Langdon said, frowning as they arrived at a 10-foot-high wrought iron security fence that circled the entire complex. He peered through the bars, unable to see much of the building in the forested compound. He felt puzzled to see no lights at all.
There, Umbra said, pointing 20 yards down the fence line. I think it's a gate.
They hurried along the fence and found an imposing entry turnstile which was securely locked. There was an electronic call box, and before Langdon had a chance to consider their options, Umbra had pressed the call button. The line rang twice and connected. Silence.
Hello? Umbra said. Hello?
No voice came through the speaker, just the ominous buzz of an open line.
I don't know if you can hear me, she said, but this is Umbra Vidal and Robert Langdon. We are trusted friends of Edmund Kirsch. We were with him tonight when he was killed. We have information that will be extremely helpful to Edmund, to Winston, and, I believe, to all of you.
There was a staccato click. Langdon immediately put his hand on the turnstile, which turned freely. He exhaled. I told you someone was home. The two of them hurriedly pushed through the security turnstile and moved through the trees toward the darkened building. As they got closer, the outline of the roof began to take shape against the sky. An unexpected silhouette materialized, a 15-foot symbol mounted to the peak of the roof. Umbra and Langdon stopped short. This can't be right, Langdon thought, staring up at the unmistakable symbol above them. Edmund's computer lab has a giant crucifix on the roof? Langdon took several more steps and emerged from the trees. As he did, the building's entire facade came into view, and it was a surprising sight. An ancient Gothic church with a large rose window, two stone steeples, and an elegant doorway adorned with bas-reliefs of Catholic saints and the Virgin Mary. Umbra looked horrified.
Robert, I think we just broke our way onto the grounds of a Catholic church. We're in the wrong place.
Langdon spotted a sign in front of the church and began to laugh. No, I think we're in the exact right place. This facility had been in the news a few years ago, but Langdon had never realized it was in Barcelona. A high-tech lab built inside a decommissioned Catholic church. Langdon had to admit it seemed the ultimate sanctuary for an irreverent atheist to build a godless computer. As he gazed up at the now-defunct church, he felt a chill to realize the prescience with which Edmund had chosen his password. The dark religions are departed, and sweet science reigns. Langdon drew Umbra's attention to the sign. It read, Barcelona Supercomputing Center, Centro Nacional de Supercomputación. Umbra turned to him with a look of disbelief.
Barcelona has a supercomputing center inside a Catholic church?
It does, Langdon smiled. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. Chapter 81. The tallest cross in the world is in Spain, erected on a mountaintop 8 miles north of the monastery of El Escorial. The massive cement cross soars a bewildering 500 feet in the air above a barren valley, where it can be seen from more than 100 miles away.
The rocky gorge beneath the cross, aptly named the Valley of the Fallen, is the final resting place of more than 40,000 souls, victims of both sides of the bloody Spanish Civil War.